Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. How important is a border? And we're not talking about the border that you might think. What's at stake when the scaffolding of peace is rearranged? Today marks 20 years of the Good Friday Agreement. That means two decades of peace in a region once plagued by violence. But the border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland is making headlines once again as the European Union prepares for the possibilities of Brexit. I'm joined in the SDPB studios at the University of Sioux Falls right now by Augustana professors Patrick Hicks and Bill Swart. Welcome, gentlemen. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Patrick, let's start with you and give us, you know, you've been on this program before talking about the Troubles. So this Good Friday Agreement essentially is the peace agreement that ends that time in history, or it marks an end in that time of history toward peace. Give us an overview so everyone's on the same page here.
Sure, it does. There's always been, for centuries, there's been a very fraught relationship between England and Ireland. And this has been going on, you know, you can go back even a thousand years where there's been friction between these two countries. And at one point in time, Ireland was a part of the United Kingdom, certainly since 1800 forward. And then when Ireland gained its independence in 1921, that's when the border was established, shortly after the Great War of 1914 to 1918. Northern Ireland became largely a Protestant state, and Southern Ireland, the Republic of Ireland, became an independent nation of its own. And this was hoped that this would solve some of the fractious sectarian problems, but in fact it only exacerbated it. And Northern Ireland became increasingly more of a Protestant state that really stripped away the rights of the Catholic citizenry. And this all came to a very strong head in the 1960s with civil rights marches. And this devolved into violence, which brought the British government and the British Army to the very streets of Belfast. And we had violence ever since about 1968, 1969. Bloody Sunday would probably be the most that would be the phrase that might resonate the most with listeners, which happened in the early 70s. And we've had this tit-for-tat violence went on for decades, essentially. And it finally everyone gathered together in 1998, and all sides agreed to stop the Troubles and to sit down and talk. And that was agreed upon 20 years ago today.
Who are the architects of this? When you say all sides, you know, we're talking who? Tony Blair and who are the people who sort of put this together? Bill, do you want to?
Yeah, one of the key architects in this was Senator George Mitchell from the United States, who really was chosen in many ways by the unionist and the nationalist communities to represent both sides, which was an unbelievable feat that he was able to pull off. He's sort of considered one of the primary negotiators in the settlement.
What's decided at that time? Everybody gets together, and what are sort of the terms of compromise, or what's on the table? What is the agreement itself?
Well, it's a really it's an extraordinary document because it actually sets out in a legal way what the relationship between the United Kingdom, Northern Ireland, and the Republic of Ireland is going to be. And we didn't really have anything before the Good Friday Agreement. And even the name is sometimes referred to as the Good Friday Agreement, sometimes referred to as the Belfast Agreement, sometimes referred to just as the agreement. But there had to be inter-party parity between eight different political entities within Northern Ireland itself. And then we had three different strands of the Good Friday Agreement. Strand one was the relationship that Northern Ireland would have with the United Kingdom. Strand two was the relationship Northern Ireland would have with the Republic of Ireland. And strand three was the relationship that the Republic of Ireland would have with the United Kingdom. So it was like this triangle. So it's really an astonishing political achievement to bring everyone together in a place where even saying the name of, say, Derry or Londonderry, it's the same city, but you have a different political allegiance whether you say the name of that particular city, Derry or Londonderry. So it is a hallmark of peace, not to say it's without its problems.
Thousands of people die before this time. Mm-hmm. That's I read 3,000 somewhere, or upwards to that number and beyond. Mm-hmm. So this is a significant change for all involved. Bill, you were just there. Were you in
No, I was in London.
You were in London. Yeah. All right. Tell me about in January the class that you took.
Yeah, so
we took London.
We took 18 Augustana students to London to study Brexit, just to try to wrap our heads around what was going on there. And so we met with a variety of political groups. We met with a variety of citizen groups to talk about what Brexit means and to really kind of to try to wrap our heads around how does a country that has been part of this multinational union since the early 1970s, since 1973, really extricate itself from that? Mm. And what are the dimensions that are involved in getting that job done?
So, Patrick, we're talking about two things. One, 20 years of this sort of, an amazing agreement and what was accomplished. But then also, it becomes significant because as the European Union looks at Brexit, everything is up in the air again in some ways, right? Is that an overstatement?
No, I don't think that's an overstatement at all. And actually, when Brexit happened, my first reaction was, what is this going to mean for Northern Ireland? And I dare say for most of the people that voted to leave the European Union in England, this didn't even cross their radar. Mm-hmm. They didn't even think about the sort of political bomb that they put underneath the Good Friday Agreement. I'm not in the camp that thinks that the Troubles can come roaring back because of this, but I'm fully aware that even though 20 years have passed and Northern Ireland is not in the news as the sort of epicenter of violence that it was in the 70s and 80s and early 90s, I am aware that there are still problems of integration in Northern Ireland, and I worry about what a hard border between these two countries might do to frustrate these two countries getting along with each other, this island getting along with itself.
All right. So let's dive into this notion of a hard border. What's the border like right now?
We have to bear in mind that at the moment, Ireland is the only UK country, or the only EU country, excuse me, to share a land border with the United Kingdom.
Okay.
That border right now is what we would talk about as a soft border. There are no customs controls. There are no passport regulations on that border. People, goods, and services move freely between Ireland, the Republic of Ireland, and the UK generally through that border with Northern Ireland. So that border, whereas in the past there were customs checks, there were passport controls, there were checkpoints that one had to go through that all became targets of the violence between communities in Northern Ireland, those have softened significantly since the Good Friday Agreement. If Brexit creates a hard border between the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland, those passport controls, those goods checkpoints, customs checkpoints, tariffs, and all sorts of other things will come back into play.
This is one of my concerns, and Bill has done a wonderful job sort of summarizing this, because the ghosts of the past will come back if we start seeing the British Army there. Mm-hmm. And I remember crossing the border during the Troubles, and it had a serpentine sort of concrete system that you had to drive through, and there were snipers, there were helicopters, the British Army was there, and it was threatening. And I have a very clear memory of coming from the Republic of Ireland. I had to stop at the border on my way to Belfast, and a British soldier got on with his loaded weapon, and he said very loudly with a big smile, "Any fruit, any veg, any explosives?" And we said no, and he waved us on our way. I mean, you have to make a joke out of these things, but
well, and even when we started teaching, courses on, immediately following the Good Friday Agreement, it was really interesting visually, because you take students into Northern Ireland, and the border checkpoints still remained in as a physical structure. No one was actually doing any checking anymore, but there were, big outlook posts with blast cages around them, because they were the regular sites of bombings and attacks and things like that. Large boulders have been brought in to create barriers and protection structures around the checkpoints. And it took probably, I don't know, what do you think, Patrick, like 5 years for those to begin to be dismantled away. And so it was a really interesting moment to take students, because that visual presence of what the border meant was there. Now that's not there anymore. At least for now.
Yeah, and I would hate for the listeners to think that the Good Friday Agreement was signed. It was agreed upon 20 years ago today, but there was a vote on the 22nd of May in 1998, so about five weeks afterwards, and that's what sort of ratified it into law. But it was only a few months after that, on the 15th of August, 1998, that a massive bomb went off in Omagh that killed 29 people and injured at least 100. So this very clearly did not, it was not a cure-all. by
any stretch. Let's bear in mind also that many elements of the Good Friday Agreement have not yet been implemented. So there's still a relatively segregated educational system in Northern Ireland that's not been, which is written about and discussed as part of the Good Friday Agreement, but there's been no traction on it. Mm-hmm. You know, the Northern Ireland Assembly has been essentially moribund for the past, year? Because political groups still can't see eye to eye and sitting together and sharing. One of the things the Good Friday Agreement calls for is a political structure, a devolved government in Northern Ireland that has representation from both the unionist and the nationalist communities. But the level of cooperation there has ebbed and flowed and continues to ebb and flow.
So does Brexit change this border by design, or is it something that has to be decided? Is it one of those things that, you know, Brexit is voted on and then people say, well, this is one of the things we have to talk about? Or right. Is there something that is automatically a warning sign here?
How long you got? So in June of 2016, the UK voted to leave the European Union. At that time, there was conversation about nothing had been negotiated and no decisions had been made. In March of last year, Theresa May, the Prime Minister, triggered what's called Article 50, which essentially gives the UK 2 years to negotiate a settlement. That has now been extended to the end of the year 2020. So Article 50 will lapse next March, and then there'll be another 21 months for negotiation to take place. And there's some important reasons for that I won't go into now, having to do with trade agreements and negotiating outside the EU when you're still a member of the EU. What it means for the border, right, is that these are decisions that need to be made. And the EU, I think it's fair to say, is relatively adamant that a soft border option get taken. But there are definitely political parties in both Northern Ireland and in the UK that would favor a hard border because they see a soft border as a threat to Brexit and not a true Brexit or what their constituents voted for in the referendum.
All right. So some people, this was part of what they were thinking of when they voted for Brexit, and others, it maybe didn't occur to them. But some were saying, yeah, this is part of why we want this.
Yeah, and when the vote for Brexit happened, there were a lot of people that voted for Brexit never really thinking it would actually happen. It was a protest vote against the current government, and I think there's a lot of buyer's remorse among many people in the United Kingdom now that this has been triggered. Article 50 has been triggered. There's no going back. And I have a sneaking suspicion that if the clock could be rewound and people could know what they know now, I suspect England and the United Kingdom would remain in the EU. But that can't be the case anymore.
Well, and the other important point for your listeners is that, you know, Northern Ireland as a population as a whole voted 56% to remain. So the majority of people in Northern Ireland voted to remain. The majority of that majority were nationalists. Roughly 88% of the nationalists voted to remain. Roughly 66% of the unionists voted to leave. If you look at Scotland, we have a similar dynamic. Scotland was something like 62% voted remain. So chunks of the UK voted remain, even though the entire popular vote went to leave. So that, again, adds another dimension of complexity to this. What happens when you have the majority population in Northern Ireland saying, now we really want to stay, and all of a sudden the vote of the entire UK is forcing the potential for a hard border onto it?
Can't be undone at this point. It's happening. It's just a matter of how it's happening, or are people starting to have conversations about, going back about dealing with that buyer's remorse and saying not so fast. Is that part of the conversation?
There's talk about
it,
but I think it's a done deal. I don't see another referendum being called unless there's some major triggering event that would lead for a kind of mass public outcry to, like, hey, let's reconsider this. But at this point, I'm not sure that would happen. And there's some question as to whether or not this is really a piece of British legislation that should have been handled through a referendum anyway.
Right.
Many accounts suggest that this was really, that this was really not something that should have been put to a public vote in the first place.
Yeah, it should have gone through Parliament. Or
right.
Something.
And so taking it back then to the public just adds sort of insult to injury in some ways.
All right. Let's talk a little bit about 20 years of peace is a long time, but yet it's also not outside of people's memory of, many people living are going to remember when it wasn't there, when there were the bombings and things. Yeah. So the people who are living remember the Troubles and remember Good Friday and are looking forward in their lifetimes. Is it possible? inertia has to, or, you know, the good things have to keep going, right? That would be the argument. Like, you know, we're not going to go back to conflict after 20 years of peace would be the, hey, come on argument. Is that sort of ignoring the potential of how bad things can get, or...
I think that it does ignore how deep-seated the story of violence is in Northern Ireland. You have both sides have a very sort of rich history. They have their own sets of martyrs. They have their own sort of tribal intimacies of how they might do things. And we have a whole generation now of 20-year-olds that haven't known violence. And there is the lure of violence, which can be attractive to a group of younger people. And... you know, the fact that there has been peace in Northern Ireland is sort of propped up around the world as a monumental achievement, and it is. I don't want to downplay that. And yet I'm fully aware that there are whole areas of Northern Ireland that are not integrated, like the city of Derry is very much separated between loyalists and nationalists. And you say the same thing about Belfast. In fact, it's entirely possible that you could have your whole education from the time you're born until you're about 18, that you might not even substantially spend time with someone from the other community until you get to university. Mm-hmm. You know, you'll meet them in shops and in pubs, but I mean, the day-to-day of going to class and learning about them. So that worries me, that sort of distrust and not knowing the other side as well as I think needs to be done.
I think you see it in the press a little bit too. So if you follow it closely, what you hear is the sort of unionist leaning politicians and press talking about what their interests are and why they hate the idea and why they really want to remain part of the UK. And you hear people on the nationalist side talk about what a hard border would do to their understanding of Ireland, and there's no cross-community dialogue, or very little that you see at least represented publicly. And I think that's an indicator of the level of divide that remains, even though we've had 20 years of peace. And there are certainly people. I mean, I don't want to completely borrow trouble here. I think there are certainly people who have said exactly what you said. Right, we've had this for 20 years, but there's no way we want to go back. I think you saw that already emerging within 2 to 3 years of the agreement. Mm-hmm. I remember being in Northern Ireland, and they had the community I was in had like 2 Christmas parties before Thanksgiving, public Christmas parties, because in the past you couldn't do that. People would, you know, somebody would throw a bomb in it, or it would be a site of violence, and suddenly they were all enamored with the fact that there could be a public life that there hadn't been before. But I think that I think Patrick's absolutely correct. I mean, there is a kind of deep-seated sectarianism that remains under the surface, and I think you see it come out in things like discussions of education or in these kinds of political media representations of Brexit and the border.
There is no family in Northern Ireland that has not been touched by the Troubles. Yeah. Not a single family. Everyone has been touched by the Troubles in Northern Ireland. To maybe help listeners get an idea of how big we're talking about, you know, the country of Ireland itself, north and south, is roughly about the size of Indiana, so it's very small. Northern Ireland itself is about the same size as the greater Twin Cities metropolitan area. So when we're talking about, you know, the death and murder of 3,000 people over the course of several decades, you know, this is a tight-knit community that has not forgotten the past. Mm-hmm. You know, these ancestral voices are still very strong, and they're still there. And but I take hope when I'm in Belfast and I'm walking around and I see the economic rejuvenation that I see in the north.
Some of those architects of the original Good Friday Agreement are coming out now for the anniversary, honoring that time, but then also urging, caution or thought moving forward. Hillary Clinton wrote an op-ed in The Guardian, which is the first public opinion piece, I think, that she has written, and she's chosen that issue. Does all that sort of help the conversation, of these voices saying don't, pay attention to that, or does it damage things because there's so much, you know, political baggage attached to Hillary Clinton now, for example?
The fact that she wrote it is interesting because I happened to be in Northern Ireland while the peace process was happening, and Bill Clinton was revered in Northern Ireland because he was actually one of the first American president to step in and say, you know, America will be an honest broker between both sides. He was the one that really helped George Mitchell to sit down at the table, and Mitchell did these things which might seem really small, but he had everyone sit at a circular table so that people weren't at, you know, opposite sides, and he tried to learn the lingo of what things were called in Northern Ireland, so he didn't call them potato chips. He made a point to go in and call them crisps, and, you know, he worked really hard to bring these groups together. And I think I find it very comforting and kind of wonderful to see that so many of these architects are at Queen's University Belfast today, which I'm proud to call my alma mater. It's where I got my master's degree. And it's really nice to see these photos of them. And it's a wonderful reminder to me of what American diplomacy can do in the world if we have the political will to do so.
At the same time, not that I disagree with you. I mean, I think, but at the same time, the current government in the UK has really been backed into a corner. The only reason the Conservative, May's Conservative government can serve right now is because they're supported by the Democratic Unionist parties. Mm-hmm. And so the DUP wing of the ruling government is propping up essentially May's government. And the DUP, was the only party in Northern Ireland to not support the Good Friday Agreement. They walked out.
They did.
And the DUP... And the DUP is strongly anti-Remain, and they are very, very threatened by anything other than a hard border, because what it suggests is suddenly Northern Ireland is moving toward becoming part of the Irish Republic. And so that's a very threatening thing for them to consider. So one of the things I read in the news this week is one author likened it to the DUP sort of slamming the fire door, right? And that's the hard border is what's going to be the fire door to their political ideology, and they then are responsible for propping up the current government in Westminster, which raises all sorts of complexity to this problem of the border.
Mm-hmm. 20 years of the Good Friday Agreement today. My guests have been Augustana University, Augustana College, Professors Patrick Hicks and Bill Swart. Thank you so much for being here. We appreciate your time.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks.